All right, it's the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. You know what no one ever complains about when they come over to your house for dinner? A roast chicken. Everyone likes roast chicken. And yet, so often we don't make it because we always think we need to make something more clever or original or this or that. Make a roast chicken. Everyone loves it. And joining me today is Emil Stonick, senior web editor, who in the October issue of Bon Appetit edited a piece called A Simple Roast Chicken, in which we give you a step-by-step breakdown of how to nail it every single time. And then after Emil, food director Carla Lolly Music and senior food editor Claire Saffitz get on the phone with one of our listeners, Sophia Drury, about cooking in college. I didn't know you could cook in college. Actually, I did. I cooked one time. I remember doing a dinner party when I was at University of California, Berkeley, and it did not turn out too well. But maybe Sophia will have better luck talking to Claire and Carla. She's at Georgia State University, and they talk about how to cook with a microwave and a toaster oven and all this sort of stuff you can actually do in your dorm kitchenette. But first, here is Emil and me talking roast chicken. Emil, when was the last time you roasted a chicken?
I roasted not one, not two, but three chickens for Rosh Hashanah dinner.
Wow. A couple weeks ago. For how many people was it?
It ended up being for 10. There were maybe going to be 12 or as many as 14, and then it ended up being 10 people. But
okay. We obviously have a lot to talk about because there's a lot of different ways to roast a chicken. One thing I've found, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know.
Could be.
But yes. But when you roast multiple chickens, like say you do two in a roasting pan or three like you did on a sheet tray or something, is it me or does that affect the overall cooking time?
Well, I mean, I think anytime you're putting more stuff in an oven, you're affecting the cooking time because there's just like you're putting more cold thing into hot thing.
Okay.
So that's taking temperature and that's dropping the temperature of the oven. So yes, I think you're right. In my case, I actually did those in three cast iron pans. So I know that not everybody has three cast iron pans, but
a lot of people don't even have one.
Yeah. I know. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think in that situation, it's always good to just kind of cook to the indicators. Like you kind of throw time out the window. You're like, I'm going to cook in these chickens until they're brown and, you know, check them after, you know, 40 minutes or whatever, see where they're at, set a timer for another 15.
And whether you're using a thermometer or you're doing the thing where you wiggle the leg to see if the joint is loose and cooked through. All right, so you edited a really nice package, as we say in the magazine business, in our October issue called A Simple Roast Chicken. And you really break down how to roast a chicken. And what's interesting about this, I think, is that this is kind of like in many ways the quintessential home-cooked meal.
Absolutely.
And it really is, it's as easy and simple as it can get, and yet there are like 7,000 ways to roast a chicken. And everyone you talk to has a different way, and you're like, can't we all just agree?
No, and that's, you know, it's like as much as I, you know, I've roasted a chicken so many times over the years and probably used a different method every single time. You know, when I was in college, I used the Joel Robuchon method, which like involved like roasting it on its side and then flip, you know, you roast it like 20 minutes on one, like leaning on its side, 20 minutes on the other side, and then breast up and then thighs up. And, you know, it's just like tons of, it just, it felt really complicated. And that was kind of.
But that's funny how like when you're younger, like you always want to take the most complicated path, and the older you get, you're like, you know what? I'm just going to throw it in the oven, turn it up to 450 and it'll be done in about 45 minutes. Maybe I'm wrong.
Totally. And so I think a lot, the way that we, Chris Morocco, who is the food editor on this story, the way that we kind of approached this chicken recipe is we were like, look, there's so many different ways to roast a chicken. Let's try out different things and let's try to create the most simple but also like most effective and delicious method for roasting a chicken. So there were a lot of different things that we kind of played around with to see whether they were actually made a difference, like salting it the night before and letting it air dry for 24 hours. You know, we just found that that, you know, didn't make enough of a difference for us to be able to definitively say like, oh yeah, if you're going to roast a chicken, you got to start the day before.
Or it's also like so many of us, it's Sunday afternoon, you're like, oh, you know what, I'm gonna roast a chicken tonight.
Absolutely.
And you run to the store and you get it and, you know.
Right, so we wanted to kind of break it down and find a method that was one that you could actually just memorize, that you could look at and just remember, this is how you roast a chicken. I don't even need, you know, I don't even need to look at a recipe. This is just how I'm going to do it from now on.
Well, I also think with roasting a chicken, for those people who do it often, it is less of a recipe and more of a technique or method. It's how you do it.
Right. And that was another thing that we really wanted to try to impress upon the readers is that, you know, this is the method for roasting a chicken. This method is going to work every time, and it's also infinitely riffable. And you can mix up what you're putting on the chicken, what kind of spices or, you know, different aromatics that you're rubbing on it, what you're putting under the chicken in terms of, you know, vegetables or potatoes and things like that. And then how you're finishing it, you know, how you're turning this into a meal and how you're making it feel special, whether
making
that's
a sauce,
turning those pan juices into a gravy or a vinaigrette or something like that.
All right. So I'm already getting hungry. Mm-hmm. I can already smell the roast chicken sitting, waiting for me on my cutting board at home. all right. So I'm going to read through your and Chris's basic recipe. And then later on, we can get to, you know, the vegetables or potatoes underneath, how to make this pan sauce, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Here we go. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
We have footnotes on this big type
recipe. Are you going to read the footnotes too?
Well, we can talk about them. Uh-huh. All right. Yeah, maybe you can join in with the footnotes, right?
All right.
All right. So, pat a 3.5 to 4 pound whole chicken dry with paper towels and season generously with kosher salt.
Oh, now I'm reading the footnote now. Use 1 teaspoon diamond crystal or 1/2 teaspoon Morton kosher salt per pound. So two things here that are super important. One, you need your chicken to be dry. That's like really, you know, I mean, whenever you're cooking any kind of meat, if you want to get that like brown, burnished, like delicious looking and tasting chicken, if you want browning, you need to get rid of the water. Or at least minimize the water.
So really pat it dry with paper towels.
Pat it as dry as possible. And once you salt it, some liquid is going to kind of come out of the chicken. Mm-hmm. And that's okay because it'll go back in with the salt and keep everything nice and juicy. And there's some science there that I don't totally understand. And also salting generously is super important with a roast chicken because you've got this big, you know, you've got a chicken that's also, there's bones and, you know, and there's a lot of dense meat and you really need to salt as generously as possible so that it gets all the way in there.
Penetrates.
Yeah. And, you know, you watch people season meat generally, but chicken especially. And, you know, they kind of pinch a little bit of salt and put it around. You really need to, like, pick up a handful of salt and just, like, make it rain all over that bread and
We're talking about a four-finger pinch.
Yeah, a couple four-finger pinches probably.
Okay, I have thoughts about this next one. All right, so you pat the chicken dry, kosher salt, tie the legs together with a kitchen twine, let sit 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I'm not messing with kitchen twine. Don't want to deal with it.
I think that's totally fine. I mean, this was like a little bit of a point of contention. I don't personally think it's super important to tie the legs of the bird. I mean, it keeps it kind of compact.
Yeah. Moister, perhaps.
I don't think it has any effect on the moistness.
You know what I do, which I learned, I forget who I learned this from, but I saw it somewhere years ago where you get the little legs sticking out and there's that kind of flappy skin by the legs, you know? And you cut a slit in the skin and you poke each leg like X-wise through that skin and it sort of trusses itself, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I have done that before. I often find that that's maybe even more annoying than using kitchen twine.
But it's just like if you don't have kitchen twine
around. If you don't have kitchen twine, you don't need to do it. You know, I think it's kind of like for presentation and people are like, oh, I just want to keep this.
Yes.
And also, you know, if you're using a smaller pan or whatever, you don't want the thing flopping around. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's totally necessary. And especially what you were talking about earlier, which is one of the ways to tell when a roast chicken is done, is kind of pulling at that leg and seeing how if it's floppy and starting to kind of separate and the joints are like ready to come apart. You can't really do that.
Ooh, good point.
If you've tied it.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
You know.
Okay. So. And you let sit 1 hour because you want that salt to sort of the meat to absorb the salt, right?
Right.
Okay. All right. Place a rack in the upper third of your oven and set a 12-inch cast iron skillet on the rack.
So this is super important. Where you put your chicken in the oven actually makes a really big difference. If you think about how an oven works, most ovens heat from the bottom. Mm. So that heat is coming up and then bouncing off of the top of the oven and then back down onto your chicken.
See, I have some screwy oven where I think I've got weird top heating elements. Stuff
your
on
oven's
top is burning.
Really weird.
I literally think I need to get it fixed because I think it's not, like, stuff is like getting overly done on the top. And I'm like, this shouldn't be happening this quickly.
Well, then, I mean, then you might want to,
I know.
And you're uniquely weird.
It's also electric. It's electric because we don't have gas in our building.
We can have a whole podcast about Adam's bizarre oven.
Oh, God. Stressed.
Yeah, don't get stressed. But anyways, so putting it in the upper third of your oven is key to getting as much heat to radiate down as directly as possible onto the bird.
And you're heating the pan first?
You're heating the pan first. And this was like a Chris Morocco innovation that really blew my mind and makes such a difference. You know, if you think about it, if you're putting a chicken in a cold roasting dish or whatever and you're putting it in the oven, like we were talking about earlier, just what some people refer to as thermal mass, you know, you're putting a bunch of cold stuff into a hot oven, and that stuff has to heat up before anything in the pan
can
start happening. So you put a cast iron skillet in there that's preheating along with your oven. You take that out, you put the chicken in. The chicken is the only cold thing. And then you put it in the oven and it starts cooking immediately. And it starts
cooking. Be careful when you take the very hot pan out of the oven.
Yeah, use an oven mitt or a towel.
And you also say, which is interesting, so you get it to, once the oven reaches 425, you take out the pan and to pat the chicken dry again. It says, once oven reaches temperature, pat chicken dry with paper towels again and lightly coat with olive oil.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, and that was something that also, so patting the chicken dry before it goes in is super important. You don't want that water on the outside to impede, you know, that
because
has to.
Because the salt is drawing out moisture.
Yes, absolutely. And some of that moisture is going to go back in, some of that salt's going to go in, but you want to pat it dry so that, I mean, that all that water has to evaporate before any browning happens. So get a head start on that and pat it dry. And then the olive oil, you know, I mean, chicken skin is, you know, a lot of chicken skin is just fat, but rubbing some olive oil all over it helps, just, you know, the same way that oil helps anything to brown. It is a really good conductor of heat, and having a nice, even, thin layer of olive oil all over it really helps.
But then you also say drizzle a bit more olive oil into the hot skillet.
So that's just because you're putting the bird directly into the hot skillet.
Well, that's the next sentence. Place chicken in the center of the skillet.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Having a little bit of olive oil right on the bottom just prevents it from sticking and helps to jumpstart that process, which is another thing that's really nice about this technique. If you're just doing a bird in a cast iron skillet, you don't have anything else under there, that the bottom part, you know, the underside of the bird is making direct contact with a hot skillet. So I feel like often when you roast a chicken, the bottom side gets a little neglected.
Yeah, yeah.
It can be just be a little like steamy and flabby, which, you know, people have different feelings about soft chicken skin.
Steamy and flabby is probably not the way you want to describe it
if you're trying
to sell it.
Well, just one more thing about that preheated cast iron skillet. The other thing is if you are putting vegetables underneath the chicken, which we'll talk about in a little bit, those will immediately start browning. So if you put some potatoes in there or whatever, they're going to start sizzling immediately instead of when you put the chicken
steaming
in the coal
stuff.
Pan, when they're just kind of like cooked.
A question. Let's say I don't have a cast iron skillet, but I do have like a Le Creuset Dutch oven sort of situation. Yes?
I think any cast iron or enameled cast iron vessel is going to work
here. Thickly bottomed.
Yeah, and you don't want to put your Pyrex in there or like your glass baking dish and preheat it and then put the chicken in.
But what about if I have a nice durable sort of like all clad stainless steel pan?
Sure,
that's you can do. Safe.
I'm pretty sure that would be fine. Yeah. I don't see any reason why that would be a problem.
Okay, this next sentence is one I think where people struggle, but get a little confused about. Roast 50 to 60 minutes. I think a lot of us are like, well, is it done yet? I don't want to undercook the chicken. I hate that. And then once you cut it open and it's undercooked, then you don't want to put it back in the oven.
Right.
So what is like the general principle of cooking time?
The general principle of cooking time is cook it till it's done, you know, but like, and not too much further. But, you know, once that chicken starts to really brown, you know, for something like this, to me, like, I'll probably set my alarm for 45 minutes just to peek at it. Mm-hmm. You know, I always set it for like a little bit earlier than that cooking
time.
But
what are you doing at 45 minutes? Are you taking a thermometer out? Are you cutting into it? What's your test?
At that point, I'm going to like peek at it. Take, if it looks like it's getting close to done, I'm going to take it out. And obviously, this is going to depend on your oven, the size of your bird. There's so many factors that could make a chicken roast quicker or, you know, take a lot longer. But then I'll take it out, and often I will spike it with a like an instant read thermometer or a probe thermometer into the thickest part of the breast and just take a look at what that's reading. And
You say here that the breast should register 155. It'll climb to 165 as it rests on a cutting board.
Yeah. And people really, I mean, to me, and I know this is controversial, but the best part of a roast chicken is the breast. As long as it's like spot on perfect with just like the tiniest bit of pink, you know, not like pink, like gross pink, but like.
I have some thoughts about this.
But you know,
you're gonna hear them shortly. But in general, it's somewhere around 15 minutes per pound. If you're going 4 pounds, 60 minutes.
Yeah.
Like as a ballpark, let chicken rest in skillet at least 20 minutes.
So that's super important.
Yes.
If you cut into that chicken as soon as it gets out of the oven, well, one, you're going to burn your hands. There's really no way to carve it without, and that should just be like, if that isn't an indicator enough that you need to let the chicken rest, you know, as soon as you cut into it, all those juices just start leaking out. And so giving it that time to rest and building that kind of into your cooking process so you don't have people sitting at the table, like, ready to eat.
That's a good point. Do that math ahead of time. You're like, all right, it's going to be in the oven for an hour. I'm going to let it rest, say, a half hour. Then we'll get to sit down. And that time I'm making pan sauce or whatever. So, yeah, I need to start at least an hour and a half out.
Well, and I think people are so obsessed with the idea of food coming right out of a pan or right out of the oven and going right to the table. The reality of the situation is a roast chicken, when it comes out of the oven, is still going to be hot.
Scaldingly so.
Too hot. Scaldingly hot for like 15 minutes. And then for like another half an hour is still going to be like quite warm and, you know, in a way that you would feel good about serving it. So it's like the way that I like to do it is almost like you're roasting the chicken and then you do everything else. Like while that chicken's in the oven, you're getting everything else ready. You're getting your salad ready. You're getting your sides ready. And then once the chicken is out, then you can kind of put the finishing touches on everything else, get those things to the table, and then you're going to carve the chicken. So well, it's like,
yeah, it's your time to do your other stuff.
And also, you know, room temperature roast chicken is not a bad thing.
Yeah. All right. Now, obviously, a couple other thoughts. Obviously, buy a good chicken itself. You say air chilled is something you want to look for if you can get an even better one. You say the pasture raised.
I mean, your roast chicken is only going to be as delicious as it is a good chicken, you know? So you want to look, you know, obviously, you know, and we don't make a point in this story of kind of lecturing about, you know, local, organically raised, pasture raised chickens or whatever, but, you know, buy the best chicken that you can.
Can afford. Because chickens can get pricey these days.
Oh, yeah.
A good
totally.
One. And I'm all for that because there's a reason they're pricey, and that's fine.
The reason we made a point of the air-chilled chicken is that some chickens after, maybe too much, but after the chicken's slaughtered and plucked and, you know, all of that, some chickens, the not air-chilled chickens, are submerged often in ice water bath, which to cool them down as quickly as possible. But that does tend to make them retain some of that water. Mm. So as we talked about earlier, the water being kind of the enemy of the browning and that like delicious, like meaty, chickeny flesh. Air-chilled chickens, on the other hand, are just blasted with cold air. So they're not going to retain that liquid in that same way. So that's, you know, whatever kind of chicken you're looking at, that's a good thing to look for.
Okay, next step. And I'm curious about your own personal preference on this one. We're talking about using a dry rub. And at a dry rub at its most basic is salt. And there's a great recipe on Epicurious, our sister brand, Thomas Keller's favorite roast chicken. Mm-hmm. And he just does 450, a whole ton of salt, and sticks it in the oven.
Yep.
Pats it dry again, like really super dry inside and out. You know, we have some here. You know, we have like ground fennel seeds with black peppercorns and a spice mill. You've got the ones with the curry powder, garlic powder. Are you using these or are you just a salt guy?
I mean, it really depends on my mood and kind of like what I'm trying to do. Like, I think the reality is that you can kind of put anything on a chicken and it's going
to
be delicious.
But do you need to?
I don't think that you necessarily need to, but often, you know, I'll just rub it down with some, you know, salt is non-negotiable. That's the baseline. There's no way to do this without salt. And then the dry rubs, therefore, these dry rubs don't include salt. So it's just going to be your dried spices, your aromatics. I mean, honestly, like sometimes I'll just rub it down with some garam masala, sometimes like a little bit of berber, which I really like, which is like a North African spice blend.
I like to say berber.
Berber.
Yeah.
It's nice to say. Whatever you're rubbing on that chicken, you know, obviously you want to still taste the chicken. So I normally, you know, go easy on the dry rubs, but I think it's a nice way if you roast a lot of chickens to kind of mix things up if it feels just kind of monotonous or something like that.
Okay, what I'm really excited about, so we have this skillet. You've got your nicely salted chicken, perhaps some dry rub on there. So you have like these beds of mixed vegetables beneath the chicken that is collecting all that nice chicken fat and a hot orange from the oven. The very first photo in this story is this beautifully burnished golden brown chicken on like a mattress of like thinly sliced potato like shingles. And it's like, I'm like, oh my God, that looks good.
This method is that specific. When I roasted those three cast iron roast chickens a couple of weeks ago, it was, we did all of them with the sliced potatoes. So, I mean, it's just like really thinly sliced potatoes tossed with a little olive oil,
salt,
and
pepper.
So if you
have like a mandolin, you can.
Yep.
Yep.
And then, you know, once you get that preheated cast iron pan out, you just kind of just start throwing them down in layers just all over the pan. And then you put the chicken right in the middle. And they'll start, because that pan is preheated, they'll start sizzling immediately. And by the time that all comes out, it's just all the edges are super, super crispy. They're like almost like burned potato chips. Ooh. And then the middle part is nice and soft. And then you just take that whole thing out. And I like to cut it into little wedges and arrange it on a platter.
God,
it's
damn.
So good. And it's just, it's and yeah, because really crispy and
you
browned.
You get the crispy, but as an over crisp because it's still collecting all the chicken juices and fat.
So you have a really nice range of textures, but the flavor is just out of control because it's just bathing in chicken fat and jus. And if you put any dry rub on those chickens, you're getting some of that spiciness too. It's really good.
Okay, I'm really hungry. And there's some fresh thyme in there.
Mm-hmm. But you can put kind of, you know, one thing that we're kind of advocating for is putting, if you're going to put vegetables underneath, to put kind of a thoughtful combination. I feel like often people just kind of like throw in some like celery and carrots and whatever and things that like they don't actually care about eating.
I love celery, but no one wants cooked celery, really. Not really.
Well, this is a separate podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe like poached celery?
No, I love braised celery.
That's kind of different. But
stir-fried celery?
Oh, I love that. But that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, right. We have three examples we shot. Fennel wedges and carrots. That's a nice one.
Oh, yeah.
Because both fennel can go kind of sweet, but it still has that anise flavor. Carrots really bring out their caramelization and sweetness as they roast.
Mm-hmm.
I love that one. Caramelized leeks.
Ooh, those are super good. That's really good if you have like kind of another starchy thing going. Maybe you've got some like mashed potatoes or some polenta or something like that.
Well, that's
like
a good point. Yeah. This is not like your only side, but it's like, it's that thing of like you've got the vessel, you have the heat, you have that chickeny, salty deliciousness. Why not throw something underneath
it? No, exactly. And I think that's one point that, you know, this is a built-in side dish. You know, this way, like all you really need is a green salad and you've got a super simple, delicious dinner. Obviously, you can make a lot of other things to go along with your chicken, but.
Okay, am I making this one a meal? It's like sort of like half moons of winter squash with red onions and pancetta.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really?
You read
is
that.
Is it like. Like, is that kind of like a, such as kabocha, kind of that skin on, thin skin squash?
I mean, the potato shingles are really good. And I think I'm going to make that a lot more times before I try some of these other mixtures. But the squash is really delicious. And it really, again, kind of the sweetness of the squash plays really nice with the chicken and with those wedges of red onion, which just get
I like that.
Soft.
I like, but I like your point. If I was doing the caramelized leeks or the fennel and carrots, then that would allow me to have like mashed potatoes or something elsewhere.
Totally.
You know, like these are complementary sides as opposed to like the sides.
Exactly. And then I feel like they, all of a sudden they come out and they just fit with the chicken.
Yeah.
You know, they've taken on some of that deliciousness and a little bit of the schmaltz and,
Okay. All right. Juices and pan drippings and all that good stuff. So if you don't have a bunch of vegetables in there. If you're just doing the chicken in the pan, you want to take advantage of all that stuff it leaves left behind in the base of the pan, right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, if you're just roasting the chicken on its own, you're going to get, once you take it out, there's just going to be kind of like a pool of chickeniness. You know, that's going to be
crispy bits.
Yeah. And that's going to be chicken fat, and it's also going to be juices. Mm-hmm. You still will get some of those juices if you use these. Use one of those built-in side combinations. If you put vegetables underneath, you'll still have something that you can kind of pour off. You probably won't have as much.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't count on it in the same way. But yeah, there's so many amazing things you can do with that liquid. We've got like a really awesome like no-roux gravy where you just put some, add some cream to it and just cook it down.
Well, before you do that, you're doing about a half cup of dry white wine over medium-high heat on the stovetop, right?
Right,
and
yes.
So you take it out, you take the chicken out while it's resting, take the pan, put it over medium-high heat, pour some wine in, scrape, scrape, scrape. It's going to be bubbling until it's almost evaporated, so it's absorbing all the wine flavor,
yep.
but losing the liquid, and then you hit it with the cream,
yeah.
right? And then done.
Done. And then you can just drizzle that right over the chicken. I mean, you can also make a decant that liquid. And
decant? Ooh, nice. Yep. Let me ask you a question. Do you... when you take the chicken out and it's resting, a lot of times with a turkey, because a turkey is so big, you try to skim off some of the fat in the pan before you make a pan gravy with turkey. You don't have to worry about that with the chicken.
I don't think you have to worry about that. It's not so much that it's going to be gross.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, so you can use that liquid. You can make a vinaigrette. You can also just, most of the time, just pour it right over the chicken. And just so the chicken is, you know, once you've sliced it,
yes.
that way all of that liquid and that fat and that salt and everything just
kind of
coats all of the pieces, and you've got more surface area. You can also.
I am ready to open a bottle of Sancerre right now.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds good.
Little crisp green salad.
Ooh.
Damn. Wait, sorry. I'm gonna cut you off because I'm this hungry now, and I want to read about this. The next one. Pan drippings croutons.
Oh my God!
All right, so it says reduce the oven to 350. Add 2 cups small pieces country style bread to a pan to pan drippings and skillet. So you've taken the chicken out, it's resting. You got a loaf of bread. You rip it up. Drizzle with 2 tablespoons of olive oil and season with salt and pepper. Scrape up any brown bits. You can add a tablespoon of water if you need to, and toss bread in all that good drippings to coat. Cook tossing occasionally until bread is golden brown and crisp.
Ooh.
12 to 15 minutes. Let cool slightly. Then toss. With 1/2 cup torn tender herbs, such as parsley and or chives and or scallions, and 1 tablespoon fresh lemon juice. That sounds delicious. So the bread is getting crispy. Mm-hmm. It's getting chicken fatty.
Yep. It's so good. These are like the croutons to end all croutons.
Yeah.
So they've got a little bit of that olive oil, but mostly it's just chicken fat and
why have I not done
juices.
This?
What's You've up? Never done this before?
No.
Are you kidding?
No, and I'm like, why not? And then you serve that on the platter with the carved chicken?
You can serve that on the platter with the carved chicken. You can also put that on top of your green salad.
Oh, on top of the green salad.
And then you just
carry
that chickeny goodness all over your dinner.
We need to make chickeny goodness t-shirts. All right, so the last one, as you referred to earlier, pan dripping vinaigrette.
Mm-hmm.
So here you take 2 tablespoons champagne vinegar or white wine vinegar and 2 tablespoons olive oil to the pan drippings in a warm skillet. And swirl to combine, season with salt and pepper if needed.
That's just a really nice thing to do, especially when you've got the kind of all of those like deep, low note flavors, and you know, the chicken, the meat, the fat.
Yeah.
And that just kind of brightens things up a little bit.
That vinegar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that'll kind of take that, just kind of, you know, bring, you know, I find that vinaigrette helps to kind of just like bring the whole meal into focus a little bit, the same way that just, you know, a squeeze of lemon would.
Or you kind of get that with the white wine in the first one. I mean, what I like to do sometimes is take the chicken out, it's resting over the skillet, I'll mince up some shallots, throw them in there till they just start to brown, then hit it with like the white wine or something, cook that down. And then if I have it, throw in a cup of like chicken stock.
Oh, yeah.
And simmer for a little bit and then hit it with a couple pats of butter or swirl. So it's like a no flour, no cream gravy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that the pan drippings, kind of no matter what you do to them, are going to be delicious. And I especially like that butter method. Just like adding a little bit of butter, those milk solids help to kind of make it creamy and feel like a little bit richer and thicker.
Well, it's so funny. Like the I was reading the Thomas Keller recipe earlier, and like that, he's dead simple, 450, just a lot of salt, pat dry, throw it in the oven for 50 minutes or so. But he was saying after he kind of carves it up, he then rubs the chicken pieces with butter. Just so they butter melts on the chicken.
Oh, wow.
That's like one of those restaurant tricks that you have no idea they're doing. You're like, God, why is this chicken so good? It's like, because it's rubbed with butter.
right, after
it came out of the oven.
Right. And I feel like no matter what, like after you've sliced it, you want to apply a little bit more. You want something that's going to get a little bit more fat and seasoning kind of all into all those little nooks and crannies and your sliced breast meat and your wing and all of that. So, I mean, you know, butter is kind of, to me, feels like gilding the lily a little bit because you've got all of that chicken fat already that you can just pour over top. But, you know, no hate.
I think we literally need to end this podcast because I have to go eat something.
Yeah.
I'm starving. And it's like 11:53 p.m. right now. A.m. Excuse me. God.
Late nights with Adam Rappaport.
It's lunchtime. All right. Emil Stana, thank you very much.
Adam, thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Carla, and I'm here with Claire.
Hey, Sophia.
Hi. Hey.
How's it going in Atlanta?
Pretty good. It's kind of hot today, so I don't know. I was getting used to the cooler weather, but oh well, because you can't be picky.
Yeah, it's still summer up here too.
Yeah.
So we want to hear all about this, like, dorm life kitchen. What is going on?
Well, so basically my roommates and I were all friends from high school. And so we really like cooking. We actually had a Saturday night supper club with all of our whole friend group where like one of us would make like supper or dinner for Saturday night. So we just really like cooking. And it's funny because we're in such a small space and none of us can actually, like, we don't have much to work with here. So I've got a microwave, a Keurig, a refrigerator, and a contraband toaster oven.
Right.
So, and then we have a little area where we can cut up stuff. So
do you guys all, you're in like a three bedroom dorm room. So it's not actually a kitchen.
No. Yeah. We make do with what we have. We also have crock pots and steamers too, because on the weekends we're kind of on our own, but we fashioned like a little desk area kind of thing. So
this is amazing. And when you cook, are you cooking for yourself or are you cooking for three or four?
It depends. Sometimes we cook for like all of us. So if we're doing kind of like rice or beans with like some spices or something, I mean, might as well just give it to everyone. But sometimes it's like just for me. So if it's like, if I bring some vegetables from home, I'll like make that for myself.
Got it.
And so, hi, Sophia, it's Claire.
Hi.
So what are the kinds of things that you like to eat on your own? Like the kind of food that you go out to eat or the kind of food that you would cook if you were back like in high school for a supper club? By the way, I also had a similar club in high school.
Of course you did.
We would just make desserts and then we pretended like it was a competition, but then we would just all eat them. No one really won. But yeah, so like when you're choosing for yourself and you have a lot of options, what are the kinds of things that you like to eat?
Well, I like vegetables. So I always try to get some sort of like, I don't know, green in there. I've really been into like now that we have the toaster oven, roasting any sort of vegetable. So I'll just bring like broccoli or asparagus up from my house and kind of roast that with like some leftover rice and stuff. So I don't know. Normally I eat pretty fresh and I don't want to say simplistic because I do enjoy like taking my time out of my day to make a nice meal and like go through all the processes. But like time-wise, it's kind of like bare bones.
Right. And I would imagine you don't, because you're in a small area, like it can't get too smoky. You've got this contraband toaster oven.
Yeah,
so like smells and smoke you would probably need to minimize. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. But we haven't had many problems with that thus far. So
there's a couple of things. So when I hear that there's a water kettle, I think like things that you can just pour boiling water over and they'll cook, right? So couscous.
Bulgur.
Yeah. Frika, even if you soak frika, it's like gets really soft really quickly. And then you have, it sounds like you have access to like, if you wanted to pick up already cooked rice from like a Chinese restaurant or a Japanese restaurant, you could, because it just seems like it would be a pain in the butt to like actually make rice.
Yeah.
But you could have it.
I think I've seen in grocery stores, I think it might be Uncle Ben's brand that makes sort of like par cooked rice that come in little containers and then you microwave them the rest of the way.
Cool.
And it works pretty well. I remember I needed like one cup of cooked rice for a recipe and I was like, I don't want to have to do that. And I bought it. I was like, oh, it's like pretty good.
Right.
So that to me means if you're roasting vegetables and you have some cooked grain of some kind, whether it's rice or bulgur, then you can sort of make a quick like grain salad. And that's something you can keep through the weekend and dress with a little like just olive oil and lemon juice or even vinegar.
Yeah.
And then that's the kind of thing that also gets better with time. As long as you keep some kind of like tender herbs or lettuces out that would wilt. You could make that on a Saturday morning and eat it still through Sunday night and have that around.
Totally. I really like also using my toaster oven to roast vegetables when I don't feel like turning the whole oven on and for smaller amounts, like this time of year, you know, one delicata squash you could probably fit in there, and even if you had to layer it a little bit. But I could also see just sort of going in waves, like toasting nuts, you know, in there, taking those out, put squash in, roast that, take that out. And then you could even like you said, baking broccoli, but you could even do a more leafy green like kale, you know, if you just do like, or escarole or any Swiss chard, any kind of more hearty green, and just toss that with some oil, whatever spices you like. If you like it spicy, you could add chili flake or a couple squeezes of sriracha, and then cook those down just till they're wilted, even in the oven, maybe a splash of water. And then you could make a yogurt sauce and have like a really nice kind of very well-rounded between the nuts, the starch of the squash, some greens, and then the kind of cooling, but also there's protein in the yogurt and some dairy, some richness, a little fat to keep you full. Like, that would be nice. And then put some fresh herbs on that. I'd be into that. Lemon juice.
That sounds delicious.
And then you can just mix that up. You said asparagus, you know, like whatever. It's just a matter of getting the vegetables into a size where, you know, you can put your toaster oven on for 20 minutes and they'll be done.
Yeah. Back when I had a toaster oven, I would roast tofu in it, which works really well. And that's something I still do at home, like in my normal oven, because I don't have a toaster oven in my little kitchen in Brooklyn. But like just doing a quick little miso soy coating on the tofu and cutting it into like 1-inch squares and roasting that until it gets kind of like, you know, all the water content kind of steams out and it kind of gets chewy. And I like that texture, even a little crispy around the edges. And then that's kind of like an all-purpose. I mean, that's sort of a nice source of protein for you guys. Then another thing, it's been a really long time since I microwaved like a baked potato.
Ugh.
But I just thinking about how now we're seeing so many cool varieties of like sweet potatoes. You see Japanese sweet potatoes. I happen to really like sweet potatoes.
I love all of the potatoes.
Yeah. But it sounds like something you could do potentially in the microwave. Poke some holes in it and let it go. Five to seven minutes or so.
Get fun with toppings.
Toppings, yeah. I mean, Carl, you said a yogurt sauce would be really good. Some chili flake. I like to go, because sweet potatoes are obviously sweet, I like to go super savory with the toppings. But that could be a fun little, if you're cooking with your friends, like a little baked potato bar. And you could toast some nuts in the toaster oven. And then you can also just... microwave a whole bunch and then rewarm them, cut it down the middle. You could store them in the fridge and then to rewarm them, cut them down the middle and put them in the toaster oven or microwave again. And you have, that to me feels like a nice kind of base that you can do a lot of different things with depending on what else you have around.
You didn't say shredded cheese, but I'm sure you meant to.
Oh, totally. Yes, always shredded cheese.
I did a thing... Actually, the other day with my toaster oven, because I was eating solo, and I drained, I had a can of Goya chickpeas. Shout out to Goya chickpeas. There's really a wonderful product for you right there. Don't get the low sodium ones. The other ones are perfect. I drained them, I rinsed them, I shook them out. I wasn't crazy about it, but I did preheat, you know, the little pan that comes with the toaster oven, that little square roasting pan. So I actually put that in the toaster oven and let it preheat while the toaster oven was heating up. And then I tossed the chickpeas with some olive oil and mustard seeds. And I probably put red chili flake on that and salt. And when they hit the pan, they started sizzling right away. So whatever water was like left on them. And I let them go for about 15 minutes. And they didn't get exactly like super crispy like those chickpea snacks. But they took on a lot of flavor and they had a nice little crust. And that would be great, you know, if you're going to build a salad. Something like that does, again, have a little bit of heft. But I'm also wondering, Claire, do you think she could do the egg and bread, like pandade? Is that what they're called?
In
the toaster oven.
Like as a strata style?
Yeah, strata.
Kind of casserole? Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on how big the toaster oven is. But if you and your friends are planning like a brunch or something, that's a really fun, easy dish. I've never tried it in a toaster oven. You'd have to find a baking dish
that would
fit inside. But that's just a really simple combination of like bread and cheese and beaten egg with a little dairy in it. Makes like a super satisfying kind of breakfast
meal.
You could
put greens in there too. And bake that all together. That would be yummy.
We have around us is a international kind of market that we go to. So we'll like pick up some random ingredients. Oh. The other day we had quail eggs.
Ooh.
So I don't know. We have some fun stuff. And there's a Trader Joe's. So we're like pretty stocked when it comes to like, we love trying new international foods. So we always go and figure out like what different fruits and vegetables we can try.
That's awesome.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think in that case, you can have so much fun with different condiments.
Yeah.
One really fun, great shortcut, because I love tandoori chicken, but the tandoori spice paste used to make it has a lot of ingredients, and like I would never really be able to make that on my own.
Right.
But you can go to an international market and find a jar of it. And it's high quality. It's good. It has all the spices already in it. And you can really take like boneless, skinless chicken thighs and kind of coat them in the paste as like a quick marinade and stick them in the toaster oven and bake them until they're cooked through. So that's a really fun thing. That just feels like it's a lot of bang for your buck.
Right.
You get a ton of flavor. Mm-hmm. It's really, really easy. And then I think also with the international food market, go big on condiments, because that's the kind of stuff that you'll be able to really punch up and add a ton of flavor to like all the roast vegetables that you're already doing. So get your sriracha, get some miso. I would invest in a good sherry vinegar because basically what you need to make food kind of pop and be interesting is salt, heat, and acid. A good vinegar, a good chili flake or hot sauce. Maybe keep like, you can keep some lemons or some kind of citrus around just to squeeze over something.
Yeah, we normally have lemons in the fridge, but I think an acid, like a vinegar would be nice because that doesn't take up a lot of space and it's not like fridge.
Well, I guess it's shelf stable.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll, yeah.
Yeah, I usually steer people towards sherry vinegar because it's a high quality aged product, and it's not something I think a lot of people typically use. But I think if you have a choice between a sherry vinegar and like a cheap red wine vinegar, go mm-hmm. with the sherry vinegar, and it really does sort of enliven food in a different way. So yeah, those are all things where like if you bring leftovers home from the dining hall and you're like, this was kind of so-so, you can kind of doctor it up just by adding some different like condiments or other flavors.
Yeah.
How does that give you some jumping off points?
Yeah, especially that beginning, the like roasted kind of kale, because I've never thought about doing that, especially with like a creamy dressing. Mm-hmm. So that sounds great. I've done chickpeas before, and I made them like curry. Mm-hmm. So we have like curry powder and stuff, and so we kind of made like our version of like roasted curry chickpea kind of things, and they're crunchy. I just put them in a bag and snack on them throughout the day.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
That kind of stuff. Yeah, I'm like looking for more spices, I guess, because we don't have that much room, but I know I have like 5 spice, and usually if I'm doing some sort of meat or like something sweeter, I like 5 spice on my sweet potatoes too, which
ooh,
I'm mm-hmm. a fan of nice. Breakfast sweet potatoes, but...
You might like harissa also. It comes in tubes or jars, and that the same way that it's a Moroccan chili paste mm-hmm. with other spices. And, you know, the same thing that Claire was saying, you know, putting it on chicken thighs, turning those over. You could throw some veg in the pan, some, you know, thinner carrots, and just roast that all together. That would be really great.
Yeah, stuff like
that. I'm trying to think how she could do something more meat, like ground beef or ground pork, but it's hard without a hot plate.
Yeah, I mean, in a toaster oven, you can do something sort of meatloaf style. Mm. Sophia, we have this website called Basically, and there's a mm-hmm. recipe on the site there's like a ground chicken meatball with harissa and feta and canned chickpeas. And you could do that. You could essentially do that entire thing in the toaster oven. And if you wanted to, rather than forming individual meatballs, you could just kind of do it like meatloaf style.
Right.
Yeah.
And cook it that way. That's fun because that recipe has sort of like a protein component and a like a starch component.
It's totally one. It's a sheet pan dinner.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. And the leftovers hold pretty well. So check that out at eatbasically.com. And I think even on the site, there might be some other good inspiration because all those recipes focus on simplicity and, you know, relatively mm-hmm. easy to find ingredients. So
and short on time.
Yeah, exactly.
So thank you so much. I'm really actually
cool
inspired. I'm like going to get rid of my stove and just take it down, sell all my belongings.
Yeah, make sure with what you have.
Yeah, there live like Sophia.
Yeah. Well, good luck. Let us know how it goes.
All right, will do. Thank you, guys.
Anytime.
Take all care.
Bye.
Bye.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Emma Wertzman and Carrie Polis and edited by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys, with additional music by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.